The Tom Woods Show, episode 1679.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, by now you've probably noticed that news about the virus is almost always fact-free hysteria these days. So you need my brand new free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About the Lockdown. Go pick it up at wrongaboutlockdown.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Dale Brown is back. Oh, good heavens, we have wanted to get Dale Brown on for a while. I wanted to let the dust clear a bit because I figured his media obligations were quite overwhelming. And so we've done that, and now we've got him here. And before I bring him on and tell you a little bit about him, I want to let you know that the ebook that I've been promising you on libertarian approaches to the police, featuring some of our best voices on this subject, is now available. It's free. It doesn't cost you anything. It's called The Problems with the Police and How to Fix Them, A Libertarian Perspective. You can get that over at problemswithpolice.com. Now, again, if you click the little button to get the book, there's going to be a little pop-up box that comes up. So you type in your email address so we can send you the book. But if you're running a pop-up blocker, that won't work. And then you'll write to me and say, Woods, your site doesn't work. But I'm telling you, the site does work. So you got to just disable whatever thing you have blocking my attempt to figure out where to send you your book. So problemswithpolice.com, you are really going to like it because people are talking about defunding the police and this and that. Well, most of them then come back and say, well, we don't really mean, well, we do. So check it out. You'll really, really enjoy it. Dale Brown is the brains behind and the founder of the Detroit Threat Management Center starting back in 1995. And I'm going to mention in a minute the significance of his first appearance with us quite some time ago, but the sorts of things they do to provide security and to de-escalate situations rather than escalate are extremely impressive and very, very much need to be heard in these difficult times right now, especially when people are thinking about these issues. This is Dale Brown's moment to shine. Actually, one last thing I want to just interject here now that I've done the interview and heard the whole thing. There are going to be some audio glitches here and there, and this happens from time to time. It's just one of the limitations of online broadcasting. Like tomorrow's episode is absolutely crystal clear, but every once in a while you get these audio glitches. But you won't have any trouble understanding what's said, and the message here is far too important for that to stop you from listening. So here we go. Hope you enjoy it. Dale, welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
All right, look, let me tell you something. I've done, as of this episode, 1,679 episodes of The Tom Woods Show. And to this day, I still have people telling me that number 597, which was the last time you were here, is the best one I've ever done. That's no joke. I still have people telling me that.
Great.
So we've just learned two things. You're great at this. And secondly, it's been way too long since I've had you back. So
Agreed.
I'm glad to be able to do it. And I see you've been making the podcast rounds, which is great to see. In a way, I was kicking myself. I thought, how have I let all these hosts get ahead of me? Get Dale Brown back on the show. All right. So first, for people who have had the misfortune of not hearing episode 597,
okay, first of all, Tom, let me tell you this. I've been in other countries. I've been across this country. And the one thing people say to me is, I heard about you on the Tom Woods Show. So I want you to know, thank you very much, because apparently you have not just great listeners and a great audience in general, but they remember you. They remember our interview, and these people travel. They are well-traveled. I have been stopped in airports. My wife and I have been stopped at different places, and they said, I heard about you on the Tom Woods Show, specifically in business, in social events. So you, let me just say thank you very much for this opportunity again, and your audience is great.
That is a very, very kind thing to say. Thank you. And now it makes more sense that a suitcase company advertised with me for so long. I guess I have the perfect audience for it.
Absolutely.
All right. Start off by just giving people the background on the Detroit Threat Management Center.
Essentially, we are a school. I created a system for survival in Detroit. And I'm from Ann Arbor, Michigan, but I originally came here to Detroit in 1994 because a woman was chased off a bridge in Detroit, in front of a crowd of people. A man who liked a female literally attacked her in front of a crowd. He was a very large man. And I thought if someone on that bridge was trained, they could have saved this woman who was chased off the bridge, who drowned when she jumped for safety in front of her daughter. And I thought, if I could have been there, I could have stopped him. Or if I had a student on that bridge, we could have stopped this horrible incident from happening. And then I started teaching at school, at a school I created. I started teaching, first of all, out in the parks. I had no money. And then after teaching self-defense in a school that I created, an actual facility, I made a deal with a business owner, a building owner, to allow me to teach in a facility. And what happened there was I found out that people, American citizens, were living without protection. I thought, essentially, they needed help contacting police, and I thought they needed assistance from police, so I was going to teach them how to do that. And then I found out that, essentially, they weren't being protected. There's no physical protection from predators. So 90% of the families were just regular people going to work, raising their children, and they just had no one to keep them safe from 10% of the criminal element that was allowed to harm them and prey upon them. So I decided to create an organization of volunteers to protect the community using the training system I created, actual tactics and skills. That grew into an economic opportunity because it turns out that when you stop rape, robbery, and killings from occurring in apartment buildings, all of the businesses thrive when the people survive. The people that own the buildings, the apartment buildings, began to get wealthy. So essentially, I made rich people richer by making regular people safer. So imagine right here in America, you can live safely. And as a result of your safety, other people get richer. And you, of course, are happier because you're working and going home and coming home and all your things are there. Your family's fine. No one's been raped, robbed, or killed in your home or around your home. So economic value increases. The businesses in the area, that's the stores, grocery stores, they all start to thrive because you have more customers. The police are happier because they have less crime and there's nothing on their data that shows that there's a crime in the area. So everybody's a winner. Ultimately, you have more taxpayers. So even people that like taxes are happy. And the people that want to start their own businesses, which is the majority of people, have some type of, you know, entrepreneurship going to supplement their income. And as a result, they're safe. They're safe to cut hair. They're safe to, you know, braid hair or run some type of business where they're shining shoes to doing lawns to creating print services. All kinds of businesses start thriving because the people are living safely. So I created a system that shows people how to protect themselves. And it turns out I created a protective service organization that businesses began to hire because they like the outcome, which is a positive, prosperous outcome without any type of negatives. So nothing in the news, no injuries, no deaths, no arrests, no one gets caged. We specialize in not prosecuting people by creating environments where predators cannot prey upon people or their property.
One of the key ingredients of this that's so interesting to people is precisely that you are interested in de-escalation and nonviolent solutions.
Absolutely.
And that, let's say, has not always been the case with the traditional police department. So I guess what I want to know is, given that now everybody's talking about the police and everybody has an idea of what needs to be done, what needs to be discarded, first I want to know what you think the real problems with the police are. But then I want to know, do you think these problems are coming from poor training, or do you think it's more systemic? Do you think it's that there's something wrong with the institution per se? It's not just training. So in other words, what are the problems and where do you think they're coming from?
Well, I've been training police officers since the 90s. First started training police officers in 94. And before that, I was training with police officers as a private investigator when I got out of the military and I was an airborne paratrooper. And what I learned through actual employment of police officers, I hired police officers to work. I trained police officers. Some of the police officers that I know personally are now dead because of a lack of training. None of them were killed by terrorists or, you know, extremely skilled people. And these police officers were strong and had many years on the job. And they weren't old. They were in tip-top shape. The one thing they were lacking at the time of their death was skill set development for survival, which has been my impetus for training police officers, is because if police officers are not safe, there's no way the citizens can be safe. So I don't charge individual police officers any money for training, but we do charge departments, absolutely. So the police officers, we expect them to go and provide protective services for people and keep themselves alive so they can get home to their family. But more importantly, we show police officers tactics and strategies to make sure they can make sure the public gets home to their families first and foremost. And so that being said, the core problem is institutional. And the reality is you only know about it because of high definition videos from civilians. The truth is these are the best police officers that have ever existed. They're the smartest. They're the kindest. These are the gentlest police. These are the most lawful police ever in the history of this country. They're the most highly educated than ever before in history. And these are the best police that this system could have ever created. However, what did not keep up with the technology was the training. So what was socially acceptable in the 50s, 60s, 30s, 20s, when this system was developed, is not acceptable any longer. So as a result, you're seeing it, even though you weren't there. And now it's becoming obvious that it's a problem. The truth is, this is the best it's ever been. And if you would have seen what it was before or have studied it, you'd be much, you'd feel like much worse, because this is the best it's ever been. Again, I keep saying that, but it's true. So we need to, first of all, identify the problems, the core problems. The first core problem is philosophy of purpose. The police themselves, individual officers I know, are good people that focus on protecting people because that's what they wanted to do. However, that is not, they're surrounded by a system that's not, it's not specifically for protection. It is for law enforcement. And this is why I get offended when people call us private police or private police option. We don't police anyone. We protect people. There's no correlation that's direct between the prosecution of people and protection of people. Those are two opposite things. The only way I get to prosecute someone is if I fail to protect someone or something. In other words, you have to believe you can do a crime, then you have to go perpetrate the crime, and then I catch you. Then I prosecute you. Well, that's the opposite of protection. Protection is creating conditions where the predator doesn't even want to try to do a crime, harm, rape, rob, or kill someone. Protection prevents a predator from making an action that rapes, robs, or kills someone. So the reality is, if I'm going to protect someone or something, the only way I have a positive metrics and a positive outcome is an actual value to a client is if nothing happens to them. They will not give me any credit for arresting someone who raped, robbed, and killed their family. In fact, I will be sued and lose all of my money, and I could even lose my freedom, because if I was hired to prevent rape, robbery, and killing from a family, and they actually got raped, robbed, and killed, I would be suspect number one. And then I'd be held accountable legally and civilly. For example, if I neglected to lock the door, and then they find out that I knew the killers, that would make me criminally negligent for leaving the door open. I have to prevent the conditions by law, civil and criminal, and I have to prevent the outcome if I want my business to survive and if I want me to survive. Because guess what? If I allow someone to get raped, robbed, or killed that hired me, not only is it actually a damage to the business, but guess what? They're going to be personally mad at me, and they may seek retribution. It may be legal or illegal because I allow something bad to happen to them. So this is not related to protection, is not related to prosecution and law enforcement. Law enforcement is by definition exactly what it is: the enforcement of laws after they've been raped, robbed, or killed, after people have been actually victimized. And so we watched television. We watched T.J. Hooker, Hawaii 5-0, Adam 12, Chips, Miami Vice, first version and second version. And all those TV shows were completely fake, top to bottom. But it affected us. We all have visual, mental impressions of what policing is, and that is not it. Listen, Boss Hogg and what was his name? P. Coltrane?
Yeah, well, is it Cooter? Is he the other guy?
That was the other guy, but the actual sheriff, he never tried to kill the Duke boys, Dukes of Hazzard.
Oh, Enos, maybe. I don't remember. No, it was. I can't remember either. What,
I know it was Roscoe with his gun.
Roscoe, yeah, now I'm remembering some of these names.
Roscoe, P. Coltrane. Look, Boss Hogg never told him to go kill the Hazzards in Hazzard County to kill the Dukes of Hazzard and the Duke boys. And they were running moonshine and outrunning the police. And they never, ever, you know, even tried. He never tried to kill them. And that is because, in reality, moonshine is not more important than the lives of the Duke boys. And we need to remember that life is more important than laws, that protection is about prevention, and that true prevention is not about prosecution. So we have to stop enjoying or in emphasizing cage culture, the idea that we can cage people into some kind of positive state. You can never prosecute or cage your community into a positive financial condition. And if you like money, if you like success, then you cannot possibly like cage culture. The idea that caging people will somehow create a positive outcome. Think about child support people that owe, you know, thousands of dollars in child support. Now we're going to spend $100,000 a year on them being in a cage when they owe $12,000 or less for child support or whatever they owe. So now we're going to add more debt to life. It makes no sense. So the concepts that we're working from are seriously counterproductive as a society. And the people and the police are just the same people. So whatever problems we're having with police, those are the same problems we're having with the people. And the idea that we're going to hire less trained, less knowledgeable, less skilled people and get a better result than police is completely inappropriate thinking. Less is not more. So when I talk to people about what we do, we train constantly. We test constantly. And when people are inappropriate, they get fired immediately. I once fired a guy for calling a woman a B word. First, she said he said it. I didn't know if he said it or not. I approached him, had him explain the situation. He did say the B word to her, and I fired him on the spot. You're not going to disrespect people, you know, in general, not around me. And then you're definitely not going to disrespect people wearing my uniform and representing my organization. So just calling a woman the B word is an absolute immediate termination. So you can imagine putting your hands on someone inappropriately, what would happen to you, my organization. And we don't have any lawsuits. We don't have any court dates. We have none of those issues because I run an extremely strict organization. Audio and video inside the vehicles in live, real-time, cellular cameras with constant monitoring by other people from remote locations. Everyone's tracked, vehicles are tracked, and everything's designated. And the reason why we do that is to prevent conditions for things to occur internally, as well as safety for them from external threats as well. So we can create the conditions in a society that are safe, or we can continue to create conditions where predatory people can prey upon people because they happen to be a priest or a teacher or some other position that we did not create safeguards against. And the reality is we, the people, are the problem, and we, the people, are the solution. And what we have to do to be the solution is look at people as family and focus on prevention of violence, prevention of the number one enemy of humanity, which is itself violence. That's what the number one enemy is. Righteous violence is still violence. So focusing on the use of a gun, the use of beating people, the use of legal use of force, monopoly of force, the concepts of force are the problem. So we just need to realize that the key to protecting human beings is love, love of humanity, and protection is truly the highest form of love.
I agree with all that. And so I want to ask you a question which may turn out to misunderstand your role, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Given that right now the future of the police in some cities is somewhat uncertain because we're hearing slogans like defund the police, and it's not clear that everybody uttering that slogan really knows what they mean by it, but they want to say it. And some of them say that they want some more community-based policing, or they want to decentralize the police so that the officers themselves are patrolling areas that they themselves live in, that kind of thing, so that there'd be fewer opportunities for misunderstanding and for conflict escalation and so on. So
all these things are false. All those things are false.
Oh, all right. Okay, so definitely correct me on those things. But what I want to know is your model something where if a part of a city said to you, Dale Brown, we're handing you the keys, we want security from your people in our neighborhood, is that something you'd be prepared to do?
That's what we already do, and defunding the police already happened. So Detroit's an example of what defunding the police is. Have you seen what happens when someone lives next to you and their kid beats your kid up? If you're a cop and your kid beats up the kid next door, now what? Or how about your kid gets beat up by the kid next door? It's not like a normal situation. You're a police officer here. How about you think the people next door are dealing drugs and they're your friends of your kid?
Yeah.
Now what do you do? How about a drug dealer? This state trooper told me, a drug dealer, for sure, a serious one, lives next door to him and his wife. Now, what happens if he gets busted, the drug dealer? What's state trooper supposed to do? He's supposed to move out of his neighborhood? How about this? How about what if the criminal next door thinks that that he busted him? Isn't this family in trouble, in danger? Yeah, police are people. You don't want that crossover, I promise you. If you just think about the real stories you know about people, you'll see how terrible the idea is, especially when you see, like, we deal a lot of neighbor problems. People that went to college and have nice homes have neighbor problems. So imagine if one of them had a gun and a badge and could pull you over, and you're having a problem because you believe he's hitting on your wife, or his wife's hitting on you, or your daughter and their son were dating and now they're breaking up and his son's in trouble because of your daughter's statement against them. I mean, this stuff is real. This is really what's happening. Except, you know, when you add in the fact that they're a law enforcement officer, you've now created an entire other set of problems. What if you want to make a complaint against a police officer and the guy next door is a police officer? How's this going to go? People don't think about that. If your family members cause a problem for a police officer, no matter what it is, and you have a neighbor that's a police officer, you expect them to side with you,
yeah,
or side with the department. So they should side with you, let me be clear. But that's not going to happen until we change the culture of that group. And that group can't change its culture if we have decided, which we did back in the 50s and 30s, that the police are the enemy of what people want freedom to be able to do regardless. Okay, so let's be, you know, the concept that the guy next door is supposed to let you do whatever is weird. It's a police officer, and they're supposed to ignore, you know, illegal behavior in the community.
Yeah, no, I hear you.
Do they live in, you know, like you're drunk driving, you know, executive, you're drunk driving, executive, and you come home and you drive up,
yeah,
on your grass.
I know.
He's supposed to ignore that. You know, you're drunk driving. You're sitting in your own driveway drunk. You're his neighbor and you're an executive and they're not supposed to come investigate.
Yeah,
you.
Yeah, I got you. I hadn't thought of it this way. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it this way.
That's real. Yeah. Yeah, I know. No one's thinking of this way. And then the African-Americans are specifically saying African-American cops are the key. And that's because they have no data. So if you had data, you'd know that African-American police officers are harassing African-American people more than the European-American officers are. And that is very troubling. And I didn't know that. I mean, how would I know that? I had to learn that over 25 years. And so when I say it, it's dramatic. I'm not saying it's minimal or little. It's dramatically different. So give you an example. Three of my men have gotten tickets in the past, say, 10 years. Okay. Three, and then what's more like 15 years. Three guys have gotten tickets. They're African-Americans only. State troopers only gave us tickets. And ready for this? The African-American state troopers, they're all African-American state troopers that gave my African-American drivers tickets, and the tickets were frivolous tickets, okay? They're not like drunk driving or speeding or something. It was like a window tint on a corporate vehicle, African-American cop. I think he said he led a light, and the other one said he was something frivolous or something like that. Now, European-American cop, we never got a ticket from a European-American cop in all these years, state troopers and otherwise. And these African-Americans were veterans. One of them was a cop's son as well, as a matter of fact. And the majority of cops outside of Detroit are European American, and we do go outside Detroit, and we're still not getting tickets. So these are facts over 20 years, right? I'm just saying in the past 3 years, we got tickets. 15 years, we got three tickets. Remember, we drive 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So, and in quite a few cases, European American officers that should have given my guys tickets refused to do so.
Yeah, yeah. All right, but I really want to pin you down here because I want to know, given that Minneapolis, okay, I don't know if you saw this, but the president of the Minneapolis City Council was on CNN and was asked the fairly obvious question, if you have a, quote, police-free future, which is how she described it, and somebody is invading my home, what do I do? And her answer was, well, you know, that's really coming from a privileged position. I mean, you know, I think somebody in that situation is really getting a taste of what it's like to be a person of color in America. So in other words, the answer is just go ahead and get raped. That was her answer.
First of all, there again, all of it's false. Everything you just said, sir, unfortunately, is a fantasy from television. The police and criminals do not cross paths almost ever in violent crimes while they're being committed. Okay, so remember that 99.5% of the time, when a violent criminal commits a crime, they will cross paths with police less than once. All right?
So yeah, no, I get that. The crime has already...
The police aren't coming right now to save you. You're saving
right.
them. Okay? No matter who you are. If you live on a farm or you live in an urban community. Now,
I understand that. Yeah. But what I'm saying is, for PR reasons, that's a terrible answer for her to give on television.
Yeah, well, but see, that all the answers are terrible. So the whole concept starts with a terrible concept. See, they believe this fantasy that European Americans are safe. And if you did the math, if there was real math, you would see that European Americans are killed more than African Americans. And so they're not doing the math. We as a society are not, we're lying. So I run into European Americans all the time. I live in a predominantly European American community in the suburbs. Every house in my community is over $1 million. And three doors down from me, the family was abducted and taken to banks and robbed, obviously. And that was the year before we moved in. Okay, we moved in here 7 years ago. And in the past 10 years, we've been protecting inner city communities. There has not been one home invasion in our communities we protect in Detroit, and the family was abducted and taken to banks and robbed. So the reality is we have a fantasy that, number one, somehow protection happens. I live around the corner from police station, by the way, and the police respond quickly here. The police response time here really is 5 minutes or less, okay? So you can't blame the police for not being there. That's not their fault. It's a reality of human behavior and criminology and how crime works. I'll give you an example. Home invasion here in Detroit. A woman and her son, her home adult son, and this is one of our clients actually. I arrived after her back of her home was caved in by a bench. Five men came in her house and ransacked her house. And I got there in 7 minutes from sleep. I was actually home, and I lived near that neighborhood, so I got there in 7 minutes. Okay, and by the time I got there, there was 10 police officers already there. The police officers got there in 2.5-3 minutes at the most. And they caught absolutely no one. Not one of the five men was caught inside the house. They stole laptops and other things. They didn't abduct the people or anything or hurt the people, which is normal. Criminals usually, the thieves don't really hurt people. There's actual rapists, robbers, murders out there that might steal something, but their actual purpose is to harm people. Let's be clear about the difference too. So these are just thieves. They ran in the house, they grabbed stuff and they left inside of 1 minute, okay? That means by the time the police got there, 2.5-3 minutes later, that means that these guys had a 60-minute run, a 60-second run, or up to a 2-minute run before the police could see them and they had spread out. So in 2 minutes, how far can you run? Pretty far. That's a lot of city blocks. So there's no way that you can even put those men at that location. And my point is, blaming the police for not being able to be there very quickly is not fair to police or reality. They can't be there. So that was a dumb question to say, what do you do? Who are you going to call if the...
I hear what you're saying.
You're your own bodyguard no matter where you live, and that's why I train people, because you cannot outsource your personal protection. That's why it's called personal protection. So your listeners need to know, and I'm sure many of them already do, that they in fact are their own protection. So that's why you have to have options at your home. You have to harden your house. You have to have the ability to defend your home, because you are the protector of your family, yourself, and your home. And that's right, what I'm here to do as well, is to help people understand.
Okay, so where I was going with that question was,
yes,
in Minneapolis, you know, they're talking about defunding the police and stuff like that. What I want to know is if they said to you, because I know you're based in Detroit, but if they said to you, you have a really admirable model for what you do, and we want you to open up shop over here in Minneapolis,
yes,
could you
absolutely.
Or would you do that?
Oh, absolutely. And we're going to, regardless. We're going to be everywhere. And who are we? We are you. Wherever you live, we're going to train people in your community to protect your community. The police are a law enforcement agency. They're here for due process. You're not going to be going through the system of due process, which a lot of it's political and interpretation anyway. But what you need is you need the police to do their job, which is due process, which is what, you know, they can do, which is follow the law and enforce the laws that have been broken. Your job is protect yourself until they can get there to help you enforce laws. Enforcing laws isn't going to help you with someone trying to rape, rob, or kill you. Okay, so it's after you've subdued them, after you've stopped them, you want the police to go and enforce laws. Or, you know, if they could come there and enforce laws, that'd be great. Highly unlikely, because criminals typically don't stay where they commit crimes. They move pretty quickly. So the reality is, first, we have to understand criminality. Then we have to understand what law is. So what we're currently seeing is what happens when you have a perspective of purpose that is inappropriate. You can't tell police their job is to go out and generate income for a city by enforcing laws. That is a distortion of public safety, and that's not fair to police. That's not fair to the public. You're trying to use them as an income generator when police should be protectors. Police should be trained as protectors. If they're going to enforce law, the first thing they have to master is law. There's no reason a police officer should be expected to know the laws if they're not at least a lawyer. A lawyer is where you begin to know the law, just the beginning. Right? Then you got to apply it in the dark, in the night, in the rain, in the snow. How are you going to do that? You first have to go to law school. So it's unfair to have someone go out and say they're going to try to understand law and how to apply it in all these situations. They're not even a lawyer. Lawyers don't even specialize in all the situations. But a police officer is supposed to somehow know all the application of law under all these different conflict conditions and serious situations, legal, civil, otherwise. And then they're supposed to go interject themselves into people's lives without being at least an attorney. And attorneys get in trouble all the time for breaking the law. And to give an example, there's a state trooper here in Michigan who was an attorney with a bar card, and he tasered a kid. And the kid almost got decapitated while he was driving an ATV. You know, something that happens out in the country all the time, kids riding an ATV at 15. And instead of saying, hey, don't ride on the street or something, the state trooper, who happened to be a lawyer, tasered the kid while he was driving. And the kid, of course, lost control and was nearly decapitated. But here's the point. At least he was a lawyer. At least he knew. He should have known the law, right? But how could you expect someone to know how to enforce law if they're not even a lawyer, they didn't go to law school? So my point is, we've already set people up to fail, which is the police and the public, by putting people in a position to know and how to enforce laws and how laws apply without sending them to actual law school. 1 month of law is not enough. 2 months of law is not enough to be a person who knows the law well enough to decide who gets to die and who gets to live based on the application of law. So it's not fair to police. It's not fair to the public. So we have a formula that's wrong. So before we can say police are wrong, we have to look at the formula, and that formula is completely wrong. Think about it this way. Fire departments send firefighters out in a vehicle designed to fight fires. That vehicle has fire retardant paint. It costs between $500,000 and $1 million, and it literally carries a group of firefighters to fight one fire. The police get a family car to go towards bullets that doesn't stop bullets. And they're often in a car by themselves. You can't even go scuba diving by yourself. You're not supposed to go hiking by yourself. And police officers are sent to go to people's homes, businesses in the middle of the night by themselves. That makes no sense. So before we can even point a finger and say, this is what's wrong with the police, we first must start off with the formula that's creating an unsafe environment. Police officers have no facial protection. Their face is literally exposed more than a football player and a hockey player. Yet, what police are expected to do is way more dangerous than football or hockey combined. So what we've done is we've looked at creating a condition which can only lead to a negative outcome. And then we said to police officers, hey, we want a negative metrics. We're going to measure you by all these negatives, rape arrests, robbery arrests, killing arrests, and then prostitution arrests, and of course, drug arrests being the most important, and guns, right? Where is the positive in any of that? If you go to someone's home or someone's community and you arrest every single person who has some illegal drugs, who has illegal guns or something, if you go to someone's neighbor, you do all these arrests, how does that help the property value? It does not. It lowers the property value. Arresting all these people for breaking rules and breaking laws, how does that affect the officer? It adds stress. You're now creating more stress at work as he's now bringing negative conditions to his person or her person, right? Because they're out here not necessarily providing public safety, they're enforcing laws in a way that creates a lot of stress, right? And so then on top of that, we create these negative metrics, measurements, right? So we're measuring negatives and we expect some positives. There's no positives in jailing and caging people. So at the end of the day, we've essentially created a cage culture. We put police officers in charge of that cage culture, and that's a negative environment. There's no such thing as a positive cage culture. And then we say to police officers, why are you upset? Why are you depressed? Why are you unhappy? We created these environments, these workplace environments. We didn't make it safe for police. And if the police aren't safe, there's no way the public can be safe. And so that's why I train police personally to get rid of their fear. And when you go to my website, you'll see police officer testimonials talking about how the training they received from me is not just superior to the law enforcement training, which is easily done because, you know, the training is minimal standards. What our training does is enables police officers to take people into custody without injuring them, without positional asphyxiation, without breaking bones, without sharing blood, you know, getting blood in their hands from other people's mouths. We don't teach strikes. We teach officers how to dominate threats, and it works in real life. We teach civilians how to dominate threats and not get their property taken from them and get themselves put into a cage after successfully defending themselves. And if there was real data, which I'm definitely in favor of, people would feel differently about everything. Right now, we have no data. We have conjecture, and we have television shows that have created impressions in our mind, and it's all false. So the idea that we're going to hire more African-American police officers And then that's going to create some kind of positive is completely false. The idea that where you live, let me tell you something. If you live, have you ever tried, think about this, live where you work and work where you live. It's horrible. It's horrible. It's a horrible concept. Already things are personal. Now it's going to be 1,000 times personal, more personal. I understand why someone would think that someone living in the community, being a police officer would be great. But that's, you know, like a lot of things we think, they're not, you know, they're completely false. And that's just because we don't have any, we have no boots on the ground. We don't know. You know, you have lots of ideas about how to fix the car, but you're not a car mechanic. So if you try to fix your car, you're not a car mechanic, you actually make it worse. And that's what's happening when people start interjecting their ideas into what police should be doing, but have never actually, you know, had any experience in dealing with these issues or situations. And I've had experience in dealing with those situations personally. So I'm the guy who goes in the middle of the night and goes to the people's houses and deals with disgruntled employees and deals with lost people and finding people and helping. And the police are very positive with us. We're not in competition. They're not in competition with us because we're doing two separate functions. Our function is prevention. Theirs is enforcement of laws for things that were not prevented. It works perfectly, actually, when there's enough resources. But what happened in Detroit, which got defunded, and how Detroit got defunded naturally, you don't have to defund anything. It's natural. Defunding happens naturally. So Detroit had 7,000 police officers in the 80s, and then it didn't. So now we have 2,000 officers. By the way, crime is lower than it was in the 80s. And what happened was businesses left. So businesses left. And why is that? Because if business is not safe, business moves its employees. Business moves its resources. They will not stay where they are not safe. Their employees will not stay where they're not safe. So essentially, by focusing on the enforcement of laws in Detroit, the natural defunding took place. And then the officers' pay went down. The number of officers went down. So defunding, you don't have to try to defund. It actually happens naturally. What we want to do, though, if we don't want defunding of reality, because the reality is you don't want police out engaged in the enforcement of laws more than protection of people. So being prosecutorial focused is the problem. We need to refocus police on protection, make them protectors. You can even remove the word police and replace it with protectors and make them public protectors. Once you do that, you've realigned the officer mentally to understand my job when I go out every day is to be the hero, to actually go out here and protect the people, not to prosecute them. And so there's a psychological change that happens even with a name change. But at the end of the day, we need our higher paid police officers. We don't need as many police officers as we have now. We need higher performing police officers. And officers need to get performance paid. There needs to be bonuses. No police officer should ever be making less than $250,000 a year, because what you're asking them to do is harder than any doctor's job, any scientist. And you can't expect them to be able to do that unless you got the best and brightest people in your society. They're going to be going to a location and deciding if someone has to be shot or not. That's a lot of responsibility. For that, you want the best and brightest people in your society making those decisions, not people with minimal training standards. You want the maximum capability, maximum performance standards, and it's very difficult. And so what we did is we actually twisted things around, you know, for many different reasons. None of it's, there's no conspiracy to make things bad. It's just how humans are. We make things difficult for our different reasons. So different reasons, different people have different reasons. So there's no like conspiracy, like let's make policing bad. That's not true. Police officers go out every day and protect people successfully, de-escalate things successfully every day. Remember, what you're looking at are these horrible videos, and they are horrible. They are happening, and they are disproportionate for African-Americans to be experiencing these things. But African-Americans are not the majority of people being injured or killed by police or arrested by police ever. Never has happened. So the reality is we're also all experiencing recency bias, because CNN and MSNBC and Fox News are all showing a small snippet of reality. And then our brains, the way they work, we actually take that information and we believe that that has something to do with significance of occurrence, frequency of occurrence, or severity of occurrence, and it doesn't. What we're looking at is what a producer has decided to air on TV. That's all. So 6 of us have been shot, 1 female, 5 men. I called every news station between 1995 and 2000. Not one news station did a story on any of our shootings, or my staff members are all alive. We stabilized our wounded and transported them to level 1 hospitals. But I could not get any TV station locally or nationally to care and to actually do a story. And there, you know, we weren't in Afghanistan, we're in Detroit. My point in saying that is, remember the 9 out of 10 things that are happening, you don't see any of it on TV, on the news. You're not seeing almost anything. So what you're seeing is a very small snippet of a much larger problem. And the larger problem isn't exactly what they're showing you. The larger problem deals with a formula problem. It's a societal issue. So the first thing we have to do is add human value. We have to look at all people as our family. And once police officers, school teachers, once healthcare workers all look at people as people of their family, then things can change. We must all adopt the idea that we are all one human family and no one's more deserving of respect than anyone else, which is very hard to do since we are a society that respects wealth and accomplishment. But the reality is we have to learn to find value in all human life and think of all people. And a good tool for that is to think of all people as your extended family. And one thing I want to mention is that a good experiment for you mentally, whoever you are, no matter who you are, when you're looking at a story, change the people in the story. Say to yourself, if this was my son, if this was my daughter, would I feel the same way? And so I did that. That's one of the thought experiments I do with police officers that I train. And it changes their feelings about a lot of things. Once you can look at people as your children, as your parents, as your cousins, once you do that, I promise you, you'll see the light. You'll see what to do. And I do that with my own staff members. When they say, well, what should I do? Or what, did I do the right thing? Or did I talk to them right? I say to them, would you have spoken like that to your own mother? Would you have said that to your grandmother? If that was your granddad, he said he thinks someone's in the backyard, what would you have done? And I expect you to at least do the same thing you would do for your own family. And then as a professional, I expect you to do more, to have more procedures, more protocols, more understanding of what is the process for providing protective services for someone to keep them alive and safe. But at the very least, all we have to do as people is look at all people as extended members of our family. And I promise you, you'll come up with the right feeling and the right answer. And so typically what we do is we look at people as different than us. We look for differences, especially if it's something bad. We say, oh, they're poor for this reason, or this abuse is happening to them because it's their fault, and here's why. She married him, or she was ignorant, or she, you know, shouldn't have done that, or whatever, to try to make it okay with us that a person's been victimized. But the reality is we need to stop doing that and remember that all of us have an objective, have an obligation to do what's best in our society to make things better for others as we want things to be better for ourselves. So, you know, the golden rule, do unto others as you have them do unto you, is real. That's really just a warning that in real life, we are all going to, we're all going to experience the circle. So whatever we put out in this world is going to come back to us, negative or positive. So the more positive we are in the world, the more positive we are towards other people, the more positive the world's going to be towards us. And that's exactly what I tell people when they talk to police officers. If you go up to a police officer with a negative attitude, believe that the officer is going to be doing something negative, you're going to start to give off a signal and your body language is going to project that way. And the officer will interpret that as a threat because it is threatening. And so you have to look at the officer and believe the officer is there for good reasons and doing good things. And you have to keep that energy about yourself. And then I train police officers to do the same thing, that when they look at someone, they can't do snap judgment. They can't look at their shoes, which is part of the old training system to determine if a person is a bad person or a good person. Because Jeffrey Dahmer, who ate 19 people, 18 of them were African-American, one Asian boy, Jeffrey Dahmer was a good looking guy, according to women that would date him, that wanted to date him. And he was a great soldier and came from a two parent household. So we can't look at people and determine their value or if they're good people or bad people. We have to look at their behaviors and not their shoes and make snap judgments.
Okay, so based on that, and let me, because I know I'm trespassing on your time a bit.
Not at all.
I want to wrap up with a slight pushback because, of course, yes, Everybody wants people to go into every aspect of life with the right attitude, looking at the world the right way. But let me ask you a yes or no question. Can you get fired or, in a sense, dismissed from clients who don't want your services anymore?
Can I be fired?
Detroit Threat Management Center. Like if you're providing security for something, Can they say, we don't want you to provide the security anymore?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So here's the thing. To me, it's more important even than the attitudes and the behavior are the incentives that exist because people do respond to those. And if they have an incentive to have a good attitude, they're more likely to have one. And if they be surly.
I get your point, but I can just tell you from experience. Yeah, no, the government police concept is like a religion. So think of it this way. Have you ever seen people that believe in a religion? I don't care if it's Islam or Christianity. And then it goes away from them because a child's death or something bad happens to them and they don't believe in religion anymore.
Yeah.
Those people that were religious, they needed that religion. And it affected them very badly when they didn't have it. They deteriorated quickly. You know, some of them start doing drugs. They lose their minds. They become homeless people. All because something bad happened, the trauma, and they believe that their religion didn't carry them. And my point in saying that is that what my experience is from thousands of people that have been through my program, hundreds of police officers that I trained and employed, what I can tell you, and we're talking about actual, you know, high threat conditions, what I can tell you is almost everything we think is the opposite, okay? So example is the private sector, and I got some real world examples for you. Blackwater does not exist. Blackwater does not exist because the name has been changed several times. It's a corporate entity that has shot into crowds and killed people, even though it's a corporate entity that could both A, be in prison, which many of their employees are either A, in prison or have warrants for their arrest. And these are private sector people, okay? Now, they changed their name so they have impunity by corporate design. That's common in every kind of corporate scenario. So my point is the human behavior does not change whether you work for the government or private sector, except that the government becomes like a belief system, right? So it's not a corporate structure. And it's not fair to us to ask someone, for example, at Michigan State University to destroy the economic strength of the university, or the same thing at Penn State University, and destroy the football program because children are being sexually assaulted in the locker room and the police knew about it. And how could the police then destroy the school, destroy the name of the school, destroy the economics of the school because of rape of children? You're asking a lot of a police officer who will then arrest these people and cause harm to the economics. And then subsequently, the police themselves will be harmed. Those are officers that work for the university. So not only could they be politically harmed, meaning they could be fired by the police, the corporate police command, or excuse me, administrators at the university, but even the city police could also be affected because their budget comes from that large university that would be negatively affected by the outing of those rapists at Penn State University, for example, and Dr. Nasser at Michigan State University. So to expect the police to destroy their economic capability when they, it's going to be direct for them because they work for the university, that's not fair to their families. Those police officers want their kids to go to college. They want to have a life for themselves. And you're saying that these kids that are not their kids should be protected and their kids should lose their parents' wealth and jobs, literally.
But nobody's entitled to it. Nobody's entitled to a job.
I'm sure there's, right? I mean, there's some good cops out there that did that. Let me be clear. But most police officers, like most people, do not put integrity above the survivability of their own family. That's just not normal.
But any other service in the world, like any municipal service, I can contract with anybody I want, or there are competing agencies. Why couldn't we say in this neighborhood we want to use the Acme Security Service, and if we don't like them, we're going to contract with a different security service?
Yeah. First of all, understand this: protecting people is not a service. Okay, it's like singing. Singing is not a service. You can hire a singer. A lot easier. You can hire someone to protect your life. Okay, but imagine the concept of, I'm going to call you to come die for me. I mean, that's essentially what you're saying. You didn't say, I'd like you to come be my security, and if it's danger, I understand you got to run away. I mean, that's not what you're saying. You're not saying, if there's danger, I'd like you to come tell me it's danger. You can do that on your own. You don't need to outsource notification of danger. So essentially what you're saying is, I'd like to be able to hire someone to possibly die because I married this guy or this girl, and they're crazy right now. They're going to come kill me. I hired an employee and they're insane. I'd like to be able to hire you to come kill my employee or get killed by my employee that I decided to hire, who's now a disgruntled employee. I would like you to see that the concept is not a real concept. You see what I'm saying? Like, that's not even a real thing. So you have to have people that believe the safety of others is more important than their own if you want them to actually protect you. So that you can't say, I'm protecting you for money I'll never get. I plan to go there, get killed so my wife can have money for the new men in her life. That doesn't make any sense. It doesn't occur to you as the provider of for-profit protection that in fact you may be dying when you go around this corner until you're in that situation. And then of course, what they do in Parkland, they blame the officer for not going into the school to go shoot the active shooter kid. And if you've ever been through any active shooter training, you'd realize, I mean, actual role play, we actually have people in there. You would see the insanity of going into a space and figuring out which kid to shoot in the head. That doesn't make any sense, by the way. It just sounds good. You know, like, you know, go into school, you see the gunman, you shoot them. That's not how the brain works. And that's not how the reality of the situation works, those scenarios. And I do encourage people, you know, that's one thing about our school that we do is we do scenario-based training so people can understand the reality of the brain and how it works under fear-based conditions and the facts of the brain, biomechanics of the brain, because that's what determines your course of action is your thought process. Imagine if you don't know anything about your thought process, if you don't know human reaction time and understand 2,000 of a second is what it takes to respond to something, 1,000 of a second is what it takes to initiate action. What if you didn't know that it's 20 milliseconds for a subconscious response to any kind of stimulus, right? And it's 40 milliseconds to respond consciously to any kind of situation. So we're not dealing with human reality, the brain, and yet we have expectations of behavior. And so the first thing we'd have to do if we want to make good decisions about protection of ourselves, protection of people, and protection of services is understand the human brain. And that's one of the core issues that I have to educate people on is the understanding of the mind state. And that's where we're woefully negligent as a society is understanding human behavior and psychology as it relates to performance. And so that's why I have these schools and we're going to be expanding so we can help your listeners and their neighbors better protect themselves by being armed with a high level of understanding of human behavior, psychology, and how to use that to create conditions for non-adversarial outcomes, non-violent outcomes. And if it doesn't have to be violent, how to be in a superior position to dominate that threat.
What's your website?
Website is threatmanagementcenter.com. That's T-H-R-E-A-T, threatmanagementcenter.com. And we're also on Facebook under Vipers Threat Management and under Threat Management Center and Detroit Threat Management. So you can find us on Facebook. Also, if you Google Detroit Threat Management Center, Detroit, or Detroit Threat Management Center, Vipers Media, you'll see a lot of media stories. HBO did a documentary last year, Vice documentary, short documentary on us. And then Vice landed once several years ago. We've been on Russian TV and some other networks internationally, as well as Chris Cuomo came out last year and did a segment on our free services that we give to domestic violence victims, stalking victims, and crime witnesses. These are regular people that have someone that wants to kill them. And unfortunately, unless you're turning state's evidence, you don't actually have anyone providing actual protection for you. So my staff, we actually volunteer to protect these people. And you can see them on our website as well. There's police testimonials, there's victory testimonials. And we call the victims victories because they are victorious in overcoming violence. But essentially, we give them services for free. We protect people that can't afford any services. And we also take pride in altruism in general. That means that I don't, you know, say to employees or team members, you have to do something, but we encourage them to protect people no matter what. So when they're off duty or on duty, it doesn't matter. If it's a paid client or paying client, that doesn't matter. What matters is that you help people the same way you want your family helped in the exact same situation.
Well, I will link to that site on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/1679, so people can check it out for themselves and to hear a voice that is going to tell you things that are a little bit different from what you hear from some competing voices these days and somebody who's been doing this for, are you in your 25th year with the Detroit
Yes.
Threat Management Center?
Yeah.
How about that?
25 years of helping people survive. That's probably the best way to explain it, through education and facilitation.
By the way, that is a great tagline. 25 years of helping people survive. It's a good right. tagline.
Right. That's really what it is. You know what I mean? Like we're getting it twisted. A lot of times people are like, oh, you guys are privately policing people. Absolutely not. You're never going to pay me to police you. No one's going to pay anyone to police them. I promise you. The concept, we find someone sleeping in a car, which is something we called for and something we see in the streets. We call 911 if it's when we see the person is drunk behind the wheel or high behind the wheel or passed out. They could be having a medical emergency for all we know. So we pull up to them after we call 911, let the police know where we're at and what situation is, because it's on city streets, obviously, and on a private property. And then we knock on the door and we talk to them and wake them up. And if they're completely disoriented, we ask them for their keys, if they'll give them to us, and put them into the back seat of the car so that they don't have access to them, and we call their family to get them picked up. And I actually had a police officer say to me one day, she said, well, when you do that, we can't arrest him for being in control of the car because he doesn't have the key in the ignition. I said, ma'am, if I would have left the key in the ignition, then he would have driven away and possibly crashed into you and killed you because you actually crossed his path coming to the scene. I said, my objective was to make sure he does not drive that car while drunk and kill someone, including you. And so then, you know what's funny is this officer, she said, okay, she gets the guy into the car with the police. She takes the guy into her police car, no handcuffs, takes him to the police station and calls his family, which is exactly the same thing we do anyway. And so you don't, there's no impetus for violence. There's no, that's not necessary. Something happened while watching TV and inculcation that somehow violence and force is just part of what's necessary. And I can assure you, after many years of application of dealing with actual violent criminals here in Detroit, including a week ago, we caught a guy trying to go into two different houses, and we took him into custody by telling him to wait for the police. And which he did, without any handcuffs, no tackling, nothing. And then eventually we asked him, "You want to ride to the police station?" He said yes. So we gave him a ride to the police station. And otherwise, we'd wait for the police if he said, "I will just wait for the police." And and we waited for a couple hours and then took him over to the police station. When he requested transport, he actually requested it multiple times. And we called the police at least six times. So the point is, you work with your police department for due process. That guy has a family. They fully expect him to be fine, and they expect the legal process to be followed. And the families in those houses expect to not have someone break in their home. So both the private sector and the government sector both work together if they're actually going to provide a safer public safety environment. And that's what I advocate, is that the private sector can work with proper training, and I have that training. Without this training, and you're out there in the field and dealing with situations, you run an extreme risk of being the same situation that you're in, the police are in, except you don't qualify for any immunity. And people are much less understanding when something happens to their family member in your corporate versus a government situation. So I would not suggest people go out there and provide protection services without our training system specifically. And that's just because I have years of failure that I learned from that I can tell you, you know, how to do this. If you don't do it right, like I said, six of us have been shot. It's very serious out here. If you don't understand how to deal with wound care, you don't understand psychology and how to de-escalate people, you're going to have extreme violent encounters when you're dealing with violent criminals. So again, education is critically important, as well as, you know, the philosophy of purpose. Your purpose in protection has to be prevention of violence, not righteous use of violence or justifiable use of violence. So it's a paradigm shift in public safety. And again, we have 25 years of evolution, and we're going to continue to grow and take this to Chicago, New York, LA, different communities throughout this country. And then we've got people in other countries that actually want our system in their countries as well, because they want safety. They, you know, they don't necessarily don't want police, but they don't want harassment. They don't want the problematic conditions. And so we, you know, our objective is, we train police officers to get them to take their position as the protectors and law enforcement and protection combined, and to be the heroes of the people that I think they want to be in general and the people need. So that's the purpose of my training. If you go to our website and you see the police officers' testimonials, you'll see that they're very proud of their training and the fact that they're alive and safe. And that's what we advocate as well, because we need all hands on deck. We need the police, we need the private sector, and we need the people working together against predation.
All right. Well, excellent. So tomwoods.com/1679. I'll link to your site and also to the now notorious episode 597 that people talked about for so long. Because in that one, you gave us some specific examples of how nonviolently you had, for example, cleared a city street corner where there had been a lot of nefarious activity going on.
Oh, yeah.
You had such clever approaches to these things that I would never have thought of.
Mm-hmm.
Just tremendous. So we're not going to tell people these stories. They have to go listen to episode 597. We've got it over there on the show notes page. Dale Brown, I know that the demands on your time are quite overwhelming these days, and I appreciate that you made time for us today.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
All right, folks, tomorrow, our old friend from across the pond, well, that is if you're an American, he's across the pond, Dominic Frisby comes back. He's just a tremendous guy, comedian, songwriter, Bitcoin expert, author. He's awesome. I love this guy. And we're going to shoot the breeze about a number of important topics. And he's got a challenge for you guys that I hope you will accept. And we're going to have fun talking about it. So make sure you subscribe to The Tom Woods Show. TomWoods.com/Apple. You get all these episodes delivered to your device automatically. And I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.